Our first case this morning is TKK USA versus Safety National, case number 12-1988 and 12-2091.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Reeses, and I'm here today on behalf of Safety National as appellant cross appellee. This appeal involves a workers' compensation and employer's liability policy. The policy is an excess policy, meaning it pays only after the insured, TKK, spends $275,000, and excess also because it has no duty to defend, but instead a duty to indemnify for a covered loss. Now, on cross motions, the district court found that we owed coverage for an employee's asbestos suit that was barred by the Occupational Disease Act. We respectfully submit that public policy does not cover a suit where recovery was barred by the act itself. If we're correct, the judgment below cannot stand. The policy covers loss because of, and these are the important words, liability imposed upon the employer by the workers' compensation or employer's liability laws. In Illinois, this includes the Occupational Disease Act. There is no question that the underlying suit here did not seek benefits payable under the act. If the parties can agree on nothing else, they should be able to agree on that much.
Is the phrase employer's liability laws limited to statutes?
I don't believe that it would necessarily be limited to statutes depending upon the jurisdiction. Remember, this policy is written to cover a number of jurisdictions, but for occupational disease, and what we have here is an occupational disease claim, the Illinois statute only liability law.
So it could apply to common law doctrines. And in other states it does.
In other states, correct.
Okay.
And I think you have to.
Is it limited to common law doctrines that have already been established?
I think that depends upon the state of the law, as I think you
say.
So, for example, let me give you an example. So here we have a statute that says that it is the full, complete, and only measure of liability. And we have Illinois cases that say that the statute is the full, complete, and only measure of liability. And our position is simply this. If the act is the full, complete, and only measure of liability, then the common law suit cannot be part of a law.
Let's suppose, that a case is filed in front of a state trial court judge who is something of a rogue, who decides that there's a new common law or perhaps constitutional theory for finding a way to impose a common law duty on the employer.
Right.
And the insured may be 99.9% confident that such a ruling is going to be overturned on appeal. But that
it
would
happens. It happens.
It does happen.
Yes.
So what does the insured do in those situations? Aren't they entitled to look to coverage that includes baseless, groundless, and fraudulent claims?
I think that is where Judge Zagel went wrong in his analysis. This policy does not have a duty to defend. It covers...
No, it has a duty to cover defense costs, though, correct?
Defense costs when they are part of a covered claim.
And settlement,
it's not,
right?
It is not a freestanding... It is part of... The policy covers loss. Loss is defined to include certain categories.
Okay, I think where you are headed, sir, though, is a conclusion that you have duties to your insured only if they are going to lose the case.
Not true at all.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. So suppose instead of having a direct action here, we had, there were about 30-some defendants, I think, in the underlying case. Suppose one of those defendants had sued us for contribution. I mean, not sued us for contribution, sued TKK for contribution. We know under Illinois law that's covered under the policy. We know that from Virginia Surety versus Northern Insurance Company. Okay? And the reason for that is because exclusive remedy is not a bar to the contribution claim. If they defend that contribution claim, as they are entitled to do, with their own choice of lawyer and at their own expense for the first $275. And if they pay more than $275, but if they ultimately prevail, we pay it. We pay the excess of the $275. If they won the contribution claim, and if they lost the contribution claim, we'd pay it above the $275.
Okay, let's go back to my hypothetical about the rogue trial court judge.
Sure.
Where you've got an obligation to cover claim expenses, even though such claims, suits, proceedings, or demands are wholly groundless, false, or fraudulent.
Yes. But even the claim expense provision requires that the suit be brought under the employer liability law.
Okay. The argument is it's being brought under this newly created doctrine recognized by this one trial judge. Maybe wrong, maybe reversed, but people buy insurance for peace of mind.
They bought a particular type of policy that applies only on an excess basis and only for certain types of claims.
Are there any first-party common law claims that would be covered in Illinois?
None that has been cited by TKK.
Well, I'm
none that I'm aware of. None that I'm aware of for in terms of a direct action. No.
So there would never be a common law claim made by an employee
directly against the employee
that would be covered. I mean, some employees and industries are not covered by the workers' compensation law, right? And those common law claims are retained.
Well, okay. Now you get to that's a very good point. And if I can amend my answer just a little bit. For occupational disease, my answer stands. For other types, for example, you can have a common law claim that is outside the workers' comp system if, for example, the injury was intentionally inflicted. That would not be covered under the policy, but it could be brought outside the workers' compensation system. Or in this case, for example, let's suppose that the exclusive remedy, you know what, let's suppose that TKK decided that this case is not worth $275, and we don't think we're negligent. And we get to pick the defense, and we get to pick the lawyer. We're not going to raise the exclusive remedy. So instead of the rogue judge, we want to stay away from the rogue judge. We're going to simply say, we're going to defend it like any other case. They can do that. They've got the duty to defend. They can raise whatever defense they want to. But then the policy says that we don't cover the rejection of the protection of the act.
Do we know that that's what happened here?
No, I'm sorry. What happened here was they did raise the exclusive remedy provision.
Is that of record? Do we know that in the record?
I believe that is, in fact, what happened. I think that there were bills that were submitted to us that reflect that there was a motion to dismiss made, but that it was not ruled on. It wasn't denied, as the rogue judge hypothetical might suggest, but simply that it wasn't ruled on, and eventually it settled for $15,000, which might be some indication that it was a nuisance suit to begin with.
Right, but to the extent that the statute is a comprehensive bar, which I think it is in this situation, and that defense is asserted, how do we get to $500,000 in defense costs?
I'm not, you know, we don't get to control the cost as long as it's reasonable, and I can't answer that question. That question would be, I suppose, better addressed to TKK's counsel because they also defended the underlying case.
Well, that's why I'm asking if there's some other sort of a common law claim that even...
There is no common law claim. I want to be very clear in this. Illinois does not permit a common law claim by an employee directly against the employer for occupational disease. And TKK didn't cite a case. And as it stands, the only direct liability that could be imposed on TKK for asbestos exposure by an employee under the employer liability laws would be the Occupational Disease Act.
How do you suggest that we reconcile the language that Judge Hamilton has focused on in the policy about or including within the scope of the recoverable claim expenses under the indemnity of this policy for groundless claims?
The claim expense is not a separate grant of coverage. It is not a freestanding grant of coverage. It is simply a category of loss. All right? Other losses are the settlements, the judgments, or the statutory benefits. The duty to reimburse for a claim expense, I can't emphasize this enough, is no broader than the duty to pay any other category of loss. It is not like a duty to defend. And that, I think, was the problem with the district court's analysis. Although it disclaimed that it was imposing any duty to defend, the court was saying that we had to pay claim expenses because potentially
right.
might be some development in the law that could result, you know, that could result in the claim not being meritless
right.
at common law.
Cited all the cases that have to do with duty to defend under primary policies, not excess policies, and so that's just wrong.
Exactly.
But my question is, we still have this at least arguable ambiguity in the policy because the definition of claim expenses includes defense costs defending frivolous or unfounded claims, and your response to that is that that isn't what determines coverage.
Exactly, because look, there are groundless, false, or fraudulent claims that are within the scope of coverage. If you had a workers' compensation claim that was meritless.
It sounds, counsel, then like it depends on why the case is groundless, right?
Yes, if it's groundless because.
If it's a groundless because there's a statutory bar, you're saying there's no duty to cover.
Because even claim expense has to be incurred in a suit that's brought under employer liability law.
Including a groundless one. Mm-hmm. Brought under that law. So,
which, for example,
Let me try a slightly different direction, okay?
Okay.
Could, in this kind of a situation, what concerns me, frankly, is the idea that you guys, as the excess employer liability insurer, are basically getting stuck with $500,000 expense to defend what is an asbestosis case that is not recognizable really as an employee case.
Right.
In that kind of situation, could the insurance company have taken control of the defense and insisted that there be an immediate motion to dismiss those claims to the extent they were brought against TKK as an employer, to basically knock out the arguably covered claims first?
Well, I think under Section K of the policy, it talks about defense of claims, and it says that the employer shall settle or defend all claims, and that the corporation, meaning Safety National, shall not be obliged to. Now, we could associate.
I know you're not required to.
Yes.
Could you have, in order to protect your interests, make sure that
not without their consent. They've got the full control.
Okay.
They've got the full control. We could ask to come in, but they would have full control of the claim. Now, I want to go back to one thing though, in terms of what's covered and what's not covered. If somebody brings a workers' compensation claim, or an Occupational Disease Act claim, for that matter, and as it turns out, they weren't in the scope of employment, they weren't really an employee for whatever reason, okay, and TKK prevailed. But again, it cost them more than $275,000, we would start to pay the claim expense. But the reason that we're paying it is not because it was groundless, false, or fraudulent, but because it sought a liability that was brought under the employer liability laws. So the groundless, false, or fraudulent language is not a separate grant of coverage. It's simply part of if the claim is covered, we will pay even if They don't have to pay anything. One last thing before I sit down. We're certainly asking for a reversal on counts 1 and 2. I just want to briefly talk about the motion to reconsider. And very quickly, we were sanctioned by $11,000 for bringing in the motion to reconsider after we lost the first time around. Under Section 155, courts should not penalize a lawyer or a party for exercising professional judgment in the absence of a violation of the rules of ethics or procedure. And there was nothing wrong in us asking for the judge to reconsider his ruling, because we correctly pointed out that the duty to pay claim expenses is part of the duty to indemnify. It's not a broader grant of coverage like a duty to defend. And as an alternative, I think that we were not sanctionable simply because we wanted to expedite an appeal on the issue. At that point, we didn't even have the bills from the other company. We didn't know how long the rest of the claim would be pending. So respectfully, we would ask for that order to be reversed as well. I see that the white light is on, and I have reserved time for a rebuttal as well as to respond to the cross appeal. Again, we ask you to reverse. Thank you very much.
Mr. Malone.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Malone of Kelly Dry on behalf of TKK. I'd like to begin by giving a little bit of background on the underlying Perkins claim, which I think will address the question about why Thermos spent as much as they did defending the case, and also address the question about whether it might be unfair for Safety to have been in the position of defending. This was not an asbestosis case. This was a mesothelioma case where a man died of cancer, and it was brought in Madison County, Illinois, which is a difficult jurisdiction for defendants. And the complaint included 10 different counts, many of which were directed solely at TKK. Others were directed at other defendants. Out of those counts, some of them were directed against TKK as a manufacturer, which we also thought was baseless, and then some were based on intentional conduct, which we thought was baseless. And then, as we've briefed, some of the counts were based on negligence, which was also baseless because it was barred by the ODA. But this was a very difficult case in a very dangerous jurisdiction for Thermos. So Thermos did what the contract requires. It chose counsel, appointed counsel, to defend the case aggressively. It gave prompt notice at the outset to Safety. And Safety, under paragraph K of the policy, they did have the right to associate and participate in the defense if they had wanted to. And they were given notice at the beginning, and they could have done that. They never asked to do so. So Thermos defended the case very aggressively, and the reason why it settled for so little is not because it was a nuisance case. It's because Thermos outlawed the plaintiffs and were able to defend the case successfully and get it dismissed essentially for nothing.
Well, to the extent that the underlying complaint asserted claims against your client in its capacity as a manufacturer, we're not even close to the vicinity of this policy.
That's correct, and we're not suggesting that those claims triggered the duty to defend.
Well, there was no duty to defend.
I misspoke, and I should know better because this has been the duty to reimburse. And the lower court correctly cited a case under Illinois law which says if there are any covered counts, the carrier has a duty to pay the defense fees for the entire case. And that's something that's not challenged.
There's a duty to defend. Not if there's – this is an indemnity policy only.
Yes.
So that was wrong.
Well, Your Honor, may I please address that? This absolutely is an indemnity policy. However, the district court acknowledged that. On page 3 of its opinion, the very first line of its discussion
– I understand that, but then the court applied the cases that have to do with a duty to defend in a primary policy, not an indemnity excess policy. That's what the failing in the district court's approach to the case primarily rested on.
Well,
analogizing a duty to reimburse defense costs to a duty to defend, and they are not analogous.
Well, the district court in its order denying the motion to reconsider where that very point was raised by Safety, the district court explained why it had cited two cases. There was a Panther case from Michigan, another case that went with that. And the district court acknowledged that they were duty to defend cases, but that the analogy was well taken.
It's not, unless you can convince me otherwise.
Okay. Well, the economic benefit of the policy to Thermos is that the defense costs will be paid.
The insurer didn't underwrite for that.
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
The insurer did not underwrite a duty to defend. The insurer only underwrote indemnity under very limited circumstances.
Your Honor, may we put aside the label and just focus on what the policy requires? Because the policy requires that once Thermos has paid $275,000, as it did, the insurance carrier has a duty to reimburse those defense fees. And they have a duty to reimburse them not at the end of the case, but as Thermos submits the bills.
But only if it's a covered claim.
Yes.
And that's not, that's a coverage determination based on indemnity policy rules, not a duty to defend determination based on the potentiality of coverage. There must be coverage in the affirmative sense, not just the mere potential for coverage, in order for the duty to reimburse to be triggered. And that's where the district court went wrong, and that's the flaw in your argument.
Well, let's look at the policy and determine whether there is coverage in the sense that I believe Your Honor is using the word. There is coverage for this claim if its substantive nature brings it within the terms of the policy. And the term of the policy is a claim under the employer's liability laws. And that term is undefined anywhere in the policy. And so the district court correctly applied the basic rules of Illinois contract interpretation, that you give it its plain, everyday, ordinary meaning, and if there's any ambiguity, that's resolved in favor of coverage. So the district court, putting aside the labels, whether you call it duty to defend or indemnity, the district court did make a decision, a determination, that the substantive nature of this claim falls within the definition of what's covered. And the fact that the claim ultimately proved to be baseless and appeared even at the outset to be baseless, the district court correctly said that is picked up by the wholly groundless language.
Well, as a legal matter, does employers' liability law in the state of Illinois include common law claims for occupational disease? Or are those exclusively channeled through the statutory compensation system?
Well, I have two responses to that question, Your Honor. First, the answer is yes. There are claims under Illinois law, as Your Honor noted in one of your questions to Safety's Counsel, that are not included by the workers' comp statute, like
those be
farm workers, domestic workers. Counsel conceded third-party contribution claims.
Any of those in play here?
No, they're not. And that brings me to my second point. With due respect, I think this question is a bit of a red herring because we're interpreting the contract as to this claim. And as the district court correctly said, and as I said a moment ago, we do have an employer's liability claim under the plain English definition that Illinois law requires.
It's a legal term of art, counsel. It's not an ordinary meaning kind of a question. It's a legal term of art in every state, not just Illinois. And these policies are written with that in mind. And the insurance companies underwrite and charge you premiums with those understandings. And you buy a policy with those understandings. So I think we need to determine as a legal matter what this policy covers. And it is not keyed to the potentiality of coverage as in a duty to defend determination. That's very clear, because this is an indemnity policy.
Well, in response to your comment about the legal term of art for employers' liability, the Illinois Supreme Court said in the Gillen case that interpreting an insurance policy, you do not give a technical legal definition you give a plain, everyday definition that an ordinary business person, such as Thermos, would believe when they bought the policy. Safety wrote this policy. If they wanted to give it a technical definition that says employer's liability equals the WCA and the ODA and nothing else, they so easily could have done that. In fact, it's curious that they did not define that term, since they define a dozen other terms, and this one is so central to the policy. So that the law is very clear in Illinois.
And multi-state policy.
Oh, absolutely. And this argument, it would be the same in every state, virtually, that a term like that that's undefined is given its plain, ordinary, everyday meaning. So when the district judge said that a claim...
There really isn't a plain, ordinary, everyday meaning in this context. This is very much keyed to what the law of the state of residence says. I mean, that's why these policies are written to cover the state statutory schemes for workplace injuries and workplace illnesses. That's the whole purpose of these policies, and that's why employers buy them.
Well, I mean, and that was Safety's argument that they said in their brief below, and they said in their brief to this court, what they believe that the right definition would be. And I acknowledge that Your Honor appears to think that's the right definition, too. But this is a contract case, and the contract, as it's written, should be construed. And Illinois law is, you know, there's 50 years of Illinois precedent that you give terms in a contract, in an insurance contract, that are written by the insurance carrier. They're plain, everyday meaning. And
is there any scenario under which this case would not be barred by the exclusivity provision in the Occupational Disease Act?
Well, yes. There's, as I said at the outset, you know, every jurisdiction has its different quirks, and there actually was not a motion to dismiss filed. It was our counsel's judgment that motion would have been just carried through trial. And as Judge Hamilton was saying, there could have been a rogue judge. We just don't know.
I'm not getting a direct answer to the question. Is there any scenario under which this mesothelioma claim was not barred by the exclusivity provision?
I can't articulate.
I understand there's intentional tort claims that were raised, but those are excluded under the intentional acts exclusion. So I'm talking about the mesothelioma negligence claims.
Fair enough. Let me be more direct. I can't articulate one other than speculation about rogue judges. And that's why our argument depended so heavily on the wholly groundless fraudulent or false language in the policy. Let's assume that this is a wholly groundless claim. We still have the right to have the defense costs paid,
right,
under the definition.
Right, but your opponent argues that covers claims that are wholly groundless but that are otherwise covered by virtue of the coverage grant language in the policy. And his argument is that this isn't covered by the coverage grant language in the policy because that only applies to workers' comp claims and occupational disease claims, because that's the universe of claims for an employee against an employer in the state of Illinois. There are no common law claims that are retained. There's the third-party contribution claims. There are claims in the farming industry, for example, domestic industry, but not otherwise. This just doesn't fall into any of those gaps where the treatises talk about this being this kind of policy, including gap-filling coverage. That's just not implicated here.
Yes.
This four corners of this complaint falls within the exclusivity bar.
Well, I agree that the other gaps don't apply here. The gap here, if you will, is a negligence claim that is in all likelihood barred by the statute.
So this is just an argument from Madison County, Illinois, that you were in a bad jurisdiction.
No, but
you might get a rogue judge.
But, Your Honor, the argument is absolutely not limited to any particular jurisdiction. I mean, I was giving some flavor of this case, but in any jurisdiction, a groundless claim is covered under the plain language of this contract and is Judge Hamilton suggested, if Safety thought that the better defense strategy was to come in and file a motion, you know, early on, they do have the right. Thermos did not have the right to block that. And also remember that Thermos undisputedly...
There's no obligation to do that. To the extent that you choose not to assert the exclusivity bar early and often, the risk is on you, not the insurer.
Well, as an excess carrier, you know, the situation would be different if they were a primary carrier. They're not. They're an excess carrier.
Well, and certainly, Your Honor, since we were on the hook for the first 275, we had every incentive to defend the case in the most effective way that we thought. So any suggestion that, you know, we ran up the costs to bolster our insurance claim, it would not be in our interest because we were on the hook for the first.
Why wasn't the bar asserted early and often?
And again, I'm going outside the record, but let me address that question. As I said, there were moving parts. There were many defendants. There were many claims. There were many, not many, but two different bases that we were being sued. And you know, our defense counsel's judgment was that such a motion would have been futile. It was better brought at the summary judgment stage. That's outside the record, but that's the best answer I can give. I see my...
You know, why doesn't that qualify as a rejection of the defense under the policy? And so even to the extent that this is covered, it's excluded. Coverage is excluded by the rejection exclusion.
Well, I'm, with due respect, I'm not even sure that there is a rejection.
There is a rejection provision in the policy. Well, it was pleaded. It's been briefed. So I'm surprised that you're surprised.
Well, then we're hung up on terminology because...
The policy says that to the extent that the employer rejects the defense, the statutory defense,
I'm
excluded.
Sorry. Okay, I misunderstood. I thought that you were saying if we rejected the carrier's efforts to defend.
No, this is exclusion three. I'm sorry, exclusion number four. Rejection by the employer of any workers' compensation law. So to the extent that you reject the defense available to you under the exclusivity bar of the statute, that risk, again, is on you.
But as I said, Your Honor, there are many strategy considerations that were going on in
well,
the defense.
I understand that. My question is, why shouldn't we construe that strategic judgment that you're alluding to as a rejection and therefore an exclusion of coverage?
No, because we paid the first $275 and...
Right, but you can't put the insurer on the hook by your litigation strategy.
Well, Your Honor, with due respect, the litigation strategy cannot be held hostage to the insurance issue. And
I understand that, but you can't run up bills, you know, on the assumption that they're going to be covered by your excess carrier if you do so by a means that's excluded under the policy, that is to say, by affirmatively declining to assert an available statutory bar.
Okay. Well, the best answer I can give, Your Honor, is that Section K of the contract does give Safety the right to
associate. But not the obligation.
Did Safety ever assert that the bills here were unreasonable?
Not during the life. I see my time is up, but I'll answer quickly.
Please.
During the life of the case, they did not. After the judge ruled in our favor and we submitted the bills, they suggested in a brief that they wanted to review the bills themselves. And then in a reply brief suggested that the court should hold an evidentiary hearing. We then submitted the bills for such a hearing, but then Safety withdrew its question about reasonableness, and that was the end.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Reeses, you have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Honestly, I didn't hear anything about the cross-appeal, so I'm going to stay away from the cross-appeal. Rebuttal. Judge Seitz is correct that the policy excludes loss under subparagraph 4, where rejection by the employer of any workers' compensation law. The exclusive remedy is as much a part of the law as any other part of the law. If they don't raise it, we don't cover the liability. And that's their right of strategy. As they say, that's their right of strategy. They, in a sense, they are acting as their own insurer.
Can you help us out here?
Yes.
You told us that a motion to dismiss was filed and not ruled upon. They've told us that no such motion
was filed. All right. All I can tell you is that we had bills that showed that a motion to dismiss was being drafted. And we made the assumption, I guess, that it was filed if it was drafted. And they made the strategy not to file it.
Does the coverage question here depend upon whether that motion was filed?
Well, if the motion wasn't filed, then I think it would be obviously excluded. Because the policy says quite clearly that we don't cover a loss where they rejected the protection. It's their matter of strategy. They get to choose the lawyer and the defense to assert. Now, maybe they thought, in good faith, in Madison County, a county that is not particularly hospitable to defendants, that it was better to litigate away without the motion, all right, but that doesn't put it on us. Now, you know, all I'm hearing today is another reason why Judge Zagel is wrong, as far if they did not file that motion. That's not a reason to affirm him. Certainly not a reason to affirm him. Talking about the claim expense, again, it's not a freestanding grant of coverage. It's part of a covered loss. It's no different than the other items of covered loss, and it's only for indemnity, not the potential, but actual coverage. We stand on all our arguments that we've made in the briefs. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to reverse on our appeal with respect to counts 1 and 2 and affirm as to the denial of 155 relief under count 4. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.